You're listening to the Petapixel Podcast. Catch new episodes every week on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Petapixel Podcast. It is Chris Nichols here. I'm joined by Jaron Schneider. Hi, Jaron.
Hello.
And Jordan Drake.
Hey, everybody. I'm going to steal the mic from you now, Chris, because as usual, I got a question to kick off the show here, help everybody learn a little bit more about us. Guys, I'm curious. Now, we have all been in relationships for a very long time, but let's think way back earlier. Going out with someone
count?
For the very first time. This is a first. Yeah, no, we're not doing body counts today. First date situation. Where are you taking that person? What are
now,
you doing?
Now
what is your activity?
No. Like when I'm younger, now.
When you're younger, what would be your default first date?
Oh.
This is what we're going to do. Hey, would you want to join me for this?
Right. Because now it would be like some sort of masochistic sex dungeon. But back then, I guess it would have been Buongiorno's. It's an Italian restaurant in Calgary. That was like a go-to. That, you know, like, you could barely afford it as a 20-year-old, so it was kind of impressive and the food was good. Yeah.
That's interesting. I did do that once. So good call, Chris.
You went to that exact restaurant?
That exact
you took
restaurant
your wife there.
On 17th Avenue. No, I took my wife there recently, but no, someone else I took on a first date there. That's fascinating. Go ahead, Jordan.
If it depends
Gonzaga
on where I am.
Gonzaga Cafeteria.
It was called the Cog, actually. So, I think if you want to ask, if I answered this question in college, it would be different than if I answered this question like at my hometown where I am now. Because if it was like a hometown where I am now, it was usually a football game because my high school is a football power, Palma. But
oh, yeah.
I think if I was to pick a restaurant in the area, it would probably be Tarpy's Roadhouse. It's really quite good.
That sounds like an exciting place.
So not one of the places you've taken us. Interesting. Do we not qualify for first date experience?
Do you want? Okay. You know what? We'll try and go to Tarpy's.
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 They do game food. You probably love it, Jordan.
Food is served on a tarp at Tarpy's.
But in college, I would say I would find some sort of activity that would be like more of a group. I don't usually do first dates alone. I think I'm more comfortable and my date is more comfortable when there's like a group of friends, more interaction.
Right.
So we would like when I was old enough to drink, we'd go to a place called the Bulldog, which is not there anymore. And then other than that, there are always on campus events that I would do. So like I find dates go better when you guys have something to do together that is not necessarily dependent on each other. So,
right.
And I think that fosters stronger relationships, and I had high success rates. So I'm going to go ahead and say that my strategy
Whoa.
Was great.
Well, back to the body count question. Jordan,
we're not doing that. Okay. So this week we've got kind of a lot going on. Our main segment, we're going to be talking to Matt Lloyd. He's a cinematographer and a director of photography, and he has a lot to talk about regarding, you know, how he approaches filmmaking and then the gear that he uses. So we'll jump into that after our news. And this week was actually surprisingly busy. Stuff broke before we hit the record button. This week, Sony actually announced a new 247 megapixel medium format sensor.
When will it end?
Yeah. How many can we do? Leica admits that selling L-mount cameras is harder than MRQ series cameras.
Sure.
Just this morning, Canva acquired Serif Affinity, the entire Affinity photo library. Like the main, I would say, closest competitor to Adobe is now under new ownership, and that is a huge move. And then late last week into the weekend, the rush to acquire the limited edition X100 VI not only basically crashed Fuji's site, it sold out in minutes, and then it was filled with, quote, suspicious purchases, likely by bots that now Fujifilm is investigating. So
right.
A lot happened. So we have quite a bit to talk about. So let's
start the show.
Let's start.
Okay. Okay, everyone, today's podcast is proudly sponsored by our friends at OM System. And right now, they've got deals that'll have you upgrading your camera gear. But you better hurry, because the offers are only available until March 31st. It's very close. We've already talked about the Tough TG7, their rugged underwater camera. It's shockproof, freeze-proof, crush-proof, all the proofs, everything-proof. And you can grab it now for $50 off. That's $500 US. Well, specifically, it's $499.99. I should definitely correct that.
Yeah, don't short them on that penny.
Be accurate.
That's not all, though. Nearly all the MZuiko Pro lenses are an incredible $200 off. And for those looking for versatility without compromising on quality, most non-pro MZuiko lenses are now up to $400 off. That includes that 75 I won't shut up about. And if that wasn't enough, there's even more to get excited about. Wow! Order the brand new OM1 Mark II and get a free BLX1 battery. I mean, it's great to have. You don't really need it because the battery life is so good on that camera, but it's included for free. That's awesome. So it is now $2,400 US. While the kit, which includes the OM1 Mark II and the 12-40 Pro 2 lens, is $3,000 US. I'm sorry, specifically $2,999.
Yes. Jordan's now shorted you on three pennies.
The savings don't stop there. What? This copy keeps going. Bundle your OM1 Mark II with qualifying lenses and save an additional $300, and you're still getting that free battery, but time is ticking. Don't miss out on these incredible deals, and remember, they're only available until March 31st. Head to explore.omsystem.com/petapixel or visit your local authorized OM System retailer to take full advantage of these unbeatable savings today, not tomorrow.
I would like to change my new first date to candlelit bathtub with TG7. That's my new first date.
Wow. First date.
Yeah.
It's aggressive.
That will cement a long-lasting relationship.
Seems presumptuous.
on the notes of OM System lenses, I'm actually using one right now. We'll probably talk about this a little bit later, and by probably definitely, but I'm not using my normal camera setup right now because as last week, as promised, I'm using a different system. I'm using the Logitech Mevo Core Micro Four Thirds camera, and it has equipped with it the MZuiko Digital 14-42mm f3.5-5.6.
Oh, it's
power
so tiny.
Zoom.
I hope it looks good.
I have no idea. I can't tell.
we'll know when we start editing the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's jump into the news stories this week because there's a lot to get through. Let's start with Sony's new 247 megapixel medium format sensor. Yes. Now, this is not one that is specifically being marketed right now as one available for consumer cameras. However, that doesn't exclude it from the possibility, as Sony's done this before. They have made a medium format sensor originally for industrial use, and it found its way into cameras you may have heard of. So,
yeah,
247. You know what's cool about this? What?
It's cool not only that it's 247, but also that it's 3:2 ratio. That is very interesting. We're not going with like a 4:3 sensor like you normally see on these giant sensors. So, that is curious to me.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing. I do strongly suspect we're going to see, you know, a 200 megapixel square version of this, you know, just slice that way for a little bit on the edges.
That'd be nice.
Because I'm not really aware of a medium format where the lenses are optimized for a 3:2 ratio. Unless Sony's going to start making that fixed lens medium format camera that I insist they make. Yeah, I strongly suspect we got a 200 megapixel 4:3 sensor coming up.
Oh, that's no fun.
I think it's lots of fun.
I mean, it's fun, but I mean, wouldn't a big giant 3:2 sensor be cool? Anyway, I don't know. We'll see
if what comes of this. Like, getting announcement of the availability of a sensor means we're years from seeing this in an actual camera, even if it's only industrial use. So just something to keep your eye on. It's a lot of resolution. I don't know who needs that much, but I'm sure there are folks who would be very happy
I'm pretty sure the GFX series started out, that sensor, well, not GFX, like everything started out as an industrial sensor too. So,
50 megapixel, which basically changed everything for medium format. Yeah. Suddenly we had high ISO to like a 35 camera. That all came from an industrial original sensor.
Yes. Exciting.
So let's get excited for what'll happen in the distant future.
Okay, well, next one is one that I don't know. I wasn't too surprised to hear this, but I was sort of surprised that they actually admitted it. Leica says that selling L-mount cameras is harder than M or Q series cameras. but they're going to keep doing it anyway. So you guys recently reviewed, well, didn't review, you had a hands-on time with the SL3.
Yes.
And compared to what you see from the other manufacturers that are working in full frame, which is basically what they're saying, you're selling a interchangeable lens, full frame mirrorless camera is harder than MRQ. Do you see Leica having a distinction here that makes them stand out that people would want? I think that's what they're trying to do.
I mean, naturally, it's tough because now you're, you know, the M and the Q, you're not necessarily competing with that many people, right?
Yeah.
They're niche products.
It's a completely unique shooting experience.
Yeah. Sure. Here, you're competing with every single full-frame mirrorless camera on the market, of which there are a lot of great ones. And I mean, look, there's no two ways about it. The Leica SL3, it does have beautiful interface. There's a lot to be said for the color theory. There's a lot to be said for just the design of it, the ruggedness of the bodies, the lens quality. Those are all absolutely substantial things. But there's no denying that an SL3 is not as versatile a full-frame camera as what else is out there. So in that regard, yeah, it is very tough to compete. You have to build off heritage, but you can't build off of performance because they just don't perform to the same degree when it comes to sports or wildlife or action kind of photography.
Yeah, I think that's really kind of where we're at, is that we always say the Leica, it's 100% about the shooting experience. That's why I think Chris really enjoys when he gets one of those cameras there. Like, a Q feels different from anything else out there, especially if you manually focus. M, obviously, there's nothing like it at this point. So if you want that shooting experience, the only option is a Leica. And I do think Leica is really trying to differentiate their cameras in terms of the interface. Like, it's pretty compelling that every button is unlabeled. You set it up exactly the way that you want it, and you almost never have to go into the menus. It does have limitations, though. Like, if I want to pass my camera off to a second shooter, they're going to have no idea what the hell is going on with it compared to, you know, most of the other cameras where your key functions have dedicated labeled buttons for doing that. But it's an interesting choice they've made. I just feel like I've said it before so many times, they need to find a way to make their entire L lineup completely unique in some way. And I don't know if that's, you know, some way that they're using the viewfinder. Like, I know, like, the new viewfinder is exactly the same as what we've seen on the older Panasonic S series, things like that. They got to find something, and then it's going to start to move. But for the time being, if you can get a very similar shooting experience with a Panasonic body, then it's going to be a tougher sell. And you're going to sell less as well, because you've got Sigma and Panasonic lens options, which is expanding right now. We've seen so many people joining the L Mount Alliance. On top of that, I'd love to know, you know, how many people are buying an SL body and exclusively using Leica lenses on it as well, you know.
Well, I think a lot, because I think the prime buyers of the SL3 are primarily going to be existing Leica users who buy it because it's a Leica.
Yeah, they say that their main thing they're focusing on is, quote, "The distinctive factors, in my opinion, are the design, the build quality, and the usability. Leica image quality, the versatility when it comes to L-mount, which you just spoke to, and that you can offer a broad range of lenses. Not that only those with the Leica brand, there are many more options that we could offer as a single brand." So they're leaning more into L-mount having a lot of options optically, but then they're saying the main reason to pick an SL is for design, build quality, and usability, which you say they do a lot of those well. The design, though, is not super distinctive other than that new power button, which is questionable, I think.
Questionable. I got used to it.
All right, moving on. This is kind of a big deal. We have to wait and see how this unfolds in the next few months, but Canva has acquired Serif Affinity. So for anyone who doesn't know what Canva is, Canva is essentially the way that most average people who are in the creative space at businesses are creating. It's started out as a web-based, and it might still be entirely there, a web-based photo editor / PowerPointy sort of thing. You can make designs and graphic designs in it, and it has greatly advanced over time. It is now the most used browser-based photo editor / graphic design system. And the reason that this, you should know how big of an impact this has had on the industry, is that the only reason that Photoshop is available on the web, and the only reason that Adobe has made a whole thing that is entirely designed for like entry-level users, is because Canva absolutely ate them up on the low end.
Yeah,
so now Canva just acquired a high-end product. This to me signals that they are ready to try and go straight at Adobe.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're dealing with an art director on any kind of commercial gig as well, like Canva is just the default. I've seen that so much when we're looking at, you know, like an advertising plan or something like that. So it makes sense. Keep those people, you know, top to bottom in the exact same thing. Say like, hey, I'd like you to, you know, tweak this composition or fix these blemishes here. Do it right in the app natively. You know, I think that makes a ton of sense instead of round tripping it out through Photoshop, which is kind of the current workflow. But you know, every time someone goes up against Adobe, like Adobe is massive and incredibly profitable and have bags of R&D, and especially now that they've got access to their own library of information for AI stuff, this is going to be very difficult to, you know, break in with compelling new features that Adobe can't offer.
I think the long-term play here for Canva is to make the transition between what it's offering on, like on the web right now, to Affinity as seamless as possible, so that the people who are deciding, I just want a little bit more power, I just want a little bit more capability, will just be like, oh, cool, they have Affinity. It's the same thing, but just bigger, better, and stronger. And I just download it and it just works. And it syncs together with what I've worked on Canva. I can see this working for them.
Yeah. Right. I just want to say, I'm going to be, just a warning, I'm going to be muting my mic a lot and coughing because I'm just getting over a cold. You could probably tell it with my nasally voice today. So if you see me like this, I'm dying. But you won't hear it, hopefully. I'll do my best.
Just listen to the podcast.
Yes. Chris, any final thoughts on Canva, though? Or are you?
I mean, it's I've heard of Canva. I've never played with Affinity. I mean, it looks like a Photoshop knockoff in a lot of ways. But the one-time pay fee is very popular for a lot of people, right? No subscription. Although that could change.
That could very
well change.
Maybe
now that Canva's taking it over, it might change, right? Yeah. So,
well, my guess is they're likely to bundle it in with their regular Canva subscription, making people who use Canva already just a no-brainer to start using Affinity because it's included.
Be prepared. But I don't have any experience with it, but I mean, it's always good to have more competition. And yeah, I'm surprised how actually close the interface is to Photoshop.
Yes.
They were clearly going after that that kind of look.
I mean, I remember when Affinity Photo first came out, it was years and years ago. And it was just like, this is exciting because someone's trying to take on Adobe. And like a decade later, it still just has basically just coasted. And I never felt like it really truly competed, but I'm fingers crossed.
This might be what it needs.
Yeah.
This might be what it needs. Yeah.
All right. Last news story is probably the biggest one because it's like three news stories.
Yeah.
So I don't know how you guys are handling it in Canada, because each region is getting their own allotment of the 1,920 some odd X100 6 limited edition bodies. But the United States got 300 allotted to them. And so the way that they chose to do this was over the course of 3 days, they would offer 100 for sale on their website only. And if you missed it, you had, you know, another day to try. Wow. And if you missed it, you had another day to try.
So it's a first come, first serve kind of thing.
That was how they laid it out. Yes.
Wow.
So in typical first come, first serve fashion, the website, about 5 minutes or so before it was ready to go, the website slowed to a crawl. And then for the next 15 to 20 minutes, you would be lucky if you could get any page to load. We managed to get one of our guys managed to get the camera in their cart and get to the checkout before it just like petered out, and then told them they were sold out. So this was the source of much consternation for many people.
Wow.
We did find that eventually they were selling out within minutes. So those people who are stuck on the spinning wheel on the website, we're getting really nowhere. There was really no chance.
I could see this being quite popular. Yeah.
So they're all gone. And then we find out yesterday that Fujifilm said they intercepted multiple suspicious X106 orders and will cancel them and raffle them off instead.
Oh, geez.
So they were what they're going to do is they're going to find out exactly how many. They didn't specify what was suspicious. They never said that you couldn't use a bot to buy it. They were just saying you couldn't buy more than one. But I'm beginning to think that at some point they decided you can't use a bot to buy it, and those they might be removing.
Oh, yeah.
So
I could see someone trying to buy all 1,000 or, you know, like all 1,934 of them if possible. Like, it's crazy. If the States got 300, Canada gets 30. So that's going
to
be.
We only got one and they just gave it to the prime minister. That's it. Yeah,
exactly.
So I'm wondering what you guys think about how they approach this. And so what they're doing now, essentially, it sounds like the idea is if you're interested in buying it, you can put your name right. in a raffle. And then if you are selected, you get a chance to purchase it.
Right.
I feel like that should have been the route from the get-go,
yes.
as opposed to the first yeah. come, first serve in the web store. What do you guys
yeah,
think?
Yeah, we knew exactly how that was going to play out.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, I'm not going to say that Fuji doesn't mind, but they probably don't mind, right? I mean, for them, this is crazy. If I was Fujifilm right now, I'd be loving the fact that you can make these posts and make these limited editions and people will just eat it up. They'll eat it up like crazy. Like, they can't get enough of it. They could make multiple limited editions. I'm sure we'll see another limited edition next month. You know, why not?
I'm beginning to wonder if there's really any point behind these other than to immediately resell them.
Yeah, like, exactly. I was talking to my wife about this. Like, I would love an X106, but especially a limited edition. But am I going to be like, I would love this enough not to immediately flip it for like $4,000 or $5,000? More than that, probably.
It's crazy.
Once these actually get out there, I suspect they'll be going for like, yeah.
We saw some show up on eBay within minutes of the closing of the first day.
Yeah.
And the lowest we saw was $3,500, and the most we saw was $6,000. The average was around $5,000.
Yeah.
So now, interestingly, those people just listed them as soon as they got their confirmed order on like their email.
Yeah, they don't have it yet.
They don't have them yet. So ooh. I'm curious if any of those people are going to have been found as suspicious and will no longer be able to sell their cameras. I don't know. This sounds like
a huge headache.
It's a Klondike.
It's a gold rush.
Well, I think we should have like a news stinger for X106 news update this week every time on the podcast, because Fujifilm's doing a brilliant job of making us constantly talk about it.
yeah, I know.
Just
that's what
the
I'm
insane
saying,
demand.
Like, that's what I mean. I'm not saying Fujifilm wants this to be the case, but the fact of the matter is the more messy it is, the better it is for the actual product, right? Because it just builds this press and builds this hype and all this controversy. And I mean, that's great for exactly this kind of situation as far as value goes. It's going to be nuts. Yeah. Nuts.
Okay. Well, that was the week in news. Thanks, everyone, for sitting through the craziness that was the past 7 days.
We're going to... Because we have a great interview now. Absolutely.
We're going to transition to our interview with Matt Lloyd. So let's do that right now. And we're joined by Matt Lloyd, ASC, CSC, Director of Photography, Cinematographer. And you may know him from Ava DuVernay's Origin and Marvel's Spider-Man Far From Home and the Power Rangers movie, Fargo, Insecure. But, you know, make sure to look up his IMDb for everything he's done, because he has a pretty pretty long list of impressive works. He's here to talk with us about his movie making strategies, what he looks for. Chris has lots of questions for him, so does Jordan. So let's get into it.
Well, and most importantly, Matt, fellow Calgarian, just learned that. That's quite interesting.
This is true. Little known fact from the main streets of Calgary, Alberta.
Yeah. So Matt, let me start things off. First off, thank you for being on the show. We really appreciate having you.
Of course, my pleasure.
And your IMDb is extensive. You've done so much work, not just like a lot of work in one genre, but you do TV shows, feature films, lots of music videos. So can you talk a bit about the dynamic of changing creatively your mindset for all three of those?
Yeah, it's funny. It's often pointed out to me that the synchronicity of the projects that I've been on is sort of nonlinear. Right. And I think that really, I mean, you know, all I've ever done is really followed the people that I admire and believe in on their journey. And I think that the role, you know, that I play in any, or that any cinematographer is really playing in the process, is to support the visualization of an artistic endeavor that a director is undertaking. And so, you know, I've never looked specifically for, oh, I want to do this because it's period, or, oh, I want to do this because it's going to be a dark, cool thing. You know, if a good friend of mine calls me and says, we're going to do a half hour comedy with John Goodman, we're going to go do a half hour comedy with John Goodman. You know, it's
right.
I reach for like the people that I love and admire and want to be around that energy. And it tends to lead to the best stuff. And if it doesn't necessarily sync up with the aesthetic of the moment or the sort of, you know, dominant, you know, cultural ideas of the moment, that's fine. You know, it's I'm okay to veer off the path of what other folks are doing to try to support, you know, people that I think should be making things, you know, and anything.
But it's like, you can't, I mean, it's great to work with people that you get along with and that you have like a shared vision, but I always wonder about the dynamic, like when you're working with directors and you're working with art directors and all these different groups, and you try to make that visualization, is that challenging sometimes? Is it like, you know, you have the photographic idea of what you want to do. They have a sort of storyline they want to get across. Other people have look and feel. How does that all coalesce? And is it easy?
I mean, it's sometimes it's not easy at all, but the bottom line is, you know, I'm there for the director. And I haven't, you know, nothing is going to happen in a positive way on a film set if you don't have a lucid and supported director and directorial vision. It's not the way that our art form, our craft functions, you know? So I'm clearly there for one person and supporting one thing, and we decide what that thing is going to be and we go for it. And I often find that, you know, the place where you start is often where you end up, and a whole bunch of voices come in and a whole bunch of things happen. But ultimately, a lot of the time when you end up back in the place where it germinated, you get the most complete vision, certainly visual vision. I mean, obviously writing and editorial and casting, all these things have huge monumental impacts on what we're doing. But I think that, you know, when I look at something at the finish line and can remember the moments where certain choices were made and we were able to bring those to fruition, that's the most exciting for me. And a lot of that stuff gets done really early in offices like this, or in vans, or in, you know, like in someone's living room, you know, just sort of talking through what it is that's exciting about the prospects in front of us and how to bring that through. And then you end up really being, you know, I can be a very fierce defender of those ideas later on when it starts to get pulled apart and it's panicked and time and all these different things coming at you. I can really like, just remember when we talked about this, that was good. That was in a nice calm moment, you know, before it all popped off. And so it's a balance of being receptive to what's happening in front of you, but also remembering what it was that got you excited in the first place, and just, you know, coaching that through as best you can.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, it's always an interesting dynamic. I'm like, yeah, like how does, you know, I liked your answer, because like I always assume maybe like, oh, there's like all these egos flying around and, you know, it's this constant battle to try to get your vision in, or I think we should do it this way. It's like, oh, but this is the look and stuff, like, you know, or how much is decided as far as color and grade and the overall look and finish and stuff like that. So,
yeah, I mean, I think honestly, it's the things in my life that I'm most attached to were very singular visions. Somebody coming in saying, this is what we're doing. And then everybody kind of falls in and can collaborate together on it. Oh, goodness.
So for anyone listening, this is real life.
Yeah, this is real life. I'd show you what it was, but I don't even know. I just know.
Now I have the ability to, like, you know, tune the audio up, but part of me wants to keep it as is. Yeah. So everyone knows.
It'll be a character. It'll be a character.
That's just North Hollywood, like you said.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
All right.
So back with a question.
Yeah, Jordan, what do you got?
So Matt, I like, the big reason I wanted to have you on the show, I just found it like really compelling that you know, have a lot of high budget work, you know, like that, you know, we mentioned the Spider-Man movie, stuff like that. And then to suddenly shift gears completely to Origin, which I was lucky enough to see in a theater recently, which was shot on 16 millimeter film. I really wanted to talk about kind of that transition. Like, first of all, you know, what was the difference going from completely cutting edge cameras, you know, with like a proper video feed and everything like that, to going back. I assume you'd shot film previously. Jumping back to that. And like, why was that decision made? I think is really important.
I will say this of the process of making Origin, you know, and having the esteemed pleasure and honor of working with my dear friend, Ava DuVernay, on what I really believe is a monumental piece of cinema.
It is an incredible, like if it is playing nearby, I definitely recommend everybody check it out, see it on a big screen.
Yeah. I had something written on that, you know, the process of making Origin was one of extreme commitment, you know, physical, personal, creative, you know, going on a journey with a singular talent of her generation operating at peak performance. And I had a little mantra taped to my bedside table in the hotel, which just said it was all training, you know, meaning that all this other stuff that came before had led to this moment, and it was going to take every bit of it to help this foster this moment so that this movie could be manifested in the way that it was. And so I think the first part of that question is every experience that I have been blessed to have in the movie industry thus far, sprinkles of that are all over this film, because there was no aspect of it that didn't require, you know, a little bit of the visual effects training, a huge amount of the analog celluloid training, which I was blessed to, you know, come into this craft at a time when that was the dominant form, and to be able to have kind of a quick acceleration in my career that let me work in that medium in its kind of final days of being the dominant format. Prior to the transition, you know, in the early 2010s, whatever that was, whatever we call that era, early teens, I guess. You know,
the golden years, Matt. We called them the golden years.
Yeah. So
when we were young and beautiful,
it all really trained me for the journey that was Origin, and used every bit of it, and couldn't have done the work that needed to be done if I hadn't had all of that behind me. And then, you know, the second part of the question, the selection of the format was really all Ava. You know, I hadn't, the methods that we had used in our previous work, you know, she really had maximized the advantages of digital capture in my view. And so when she pivoted and wanted to follow the analog, film format for the movie, it caught me off guard a little bit at first, but then I completely understood that I think her reaction to the movie she had seen in that format, it offered her a singular format that could tell multiple time periods and multiple storylines without gimmicks and changes and in overall aesthetic. It kind of worked for the 1930s, you know, it worked for, you know, contemporary city life. It worked for, you know, it worked for all of these different eras and place settings. And the nice thing about 16 is handled differently, it can look very different. You know, when I was growing up, all we wanted to do with 16 was make it look like 35, tight grain.
Right.
Heavy exposures, dense negative, print through it, get a tight grain structure, you know, get a rich black, all of the things that were synonymous with 35, we were trying to do in 16 because we were, you know, running around Toronto broke trying to make, you know, whatever Bravo track thing on 16 millimeter to compete with the stuff that was being on 35. So you can make that format into a lot of different things if you keep it thin and, you know, kind of print it and smokier. It can look almost like Super 8 or like a really kind of
right.
Get a different look. So, you know, we weren't changing too much about what we were doing with the 16, but it offered some sameness that supported all the different time periods and storylines, and sort of gave the film a whole visual structure that allowed the metaphysical storytelling to function.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Like, for people who don't know, this takes place from like the 1800s to modern day. And usually I'd expect like, oh, we're changing, you know, the great, like a real giveaway, like, oh, we're in a different period. But the whole concept of the movie is like the stuff that was happening before is still happening today.
Yeah, exactly.
That gives it a real consistency there. I think it was a very smart decision. But I'm also curious, like you said, Ava was kind of the driving force for shooting on 16. Were there films that kind of, she was like, this is the look that I'm going for, that she was using to demonstrate to you kind of what she was going for?
Yeah, I think there was, you know, obviously the film that first came up was Carol, directed by Todd Haynes and photographed by a dear friend of mine, Eddie Lachman, which is a stunning piece of work. And I think was kind of the genesis of how that format captured a period feel that wasn't going over the top. You know, it wasn't. It wasn't feeling forced. It's a very good selection for that movie. And I think that was kind of the jumping off point for the conversation. Then obviously, you know, that the Aronofsky trilogy, which was all done in 16mm, had a certain kind of textural component that was interesting. We weren't referencing those films the way we were something like Carol, but they sort of had a point of discussion, you know, where it was like, okay, these films are doing this, like, what are we really reacting to? So there was, you know, a number of films in play. I it wasn't something that we referenced directly, but I, you know, Chris Marker's Sans Soleil is to me, you know, one of the, a truly incredible cinematic experience. And so that was something that I was watching regularly just to kind of stay in the mode of kind of the transient feel, the traveling to different areas, the kind of moving between space and time. That movie offered me a lot of kind of emotional support through the process. Not that the look has anything to do with what we were doing on the film, but it kind of the methodology and the kind of voice of it helped kind of inform some of the stuff I was doing, you know. And I'm also operating the camera, so it's, you know, there's a lot of kind of just physicality and you know, connection to the athletic endeavor of movie making when you're physically holding a film camera, as opposed to, you know, some of the different digital technology that has made things a little easier. So, you know, all of that to say that we were never going any other way. So it was just like, you know, what parts of it were we going to lean into as we got going?
And then just one more thing related to the film. So it was shot on 16. I saw it on a DCP up here. Right. Have you seen this blown up to 35 and projected?
You know, we didn't film it out. It's an interesting question. I never supervised a film out to 35. It would only be possible at this point to come off of, to film out the digital files.
Right.
You know, an optical would be an interesting endeavor, actually, and maybe something that's worth doing on a few reels just to kind of remember. But that aspect of film printing is basically gone. I don't know that I know anyone who's doing it. I guess you could maybe fire it back up just for a sequence or something if you wanted to shoot 16, blow it up to 35, print it, and then scan the print like a Locon.
Right. Because there was a DI, right?
So yeah, there was a DI. Absolutely.
Not chemical, photochemical. Yeah.
And interestingly, 16 sort of as a resolution, if you're looking for kind of a mathematical equivalent, it kind of we noticed that at sort of in the 2K realm, you get visually what you remember 16 being. Once you start scanning at 4K, which ultimately we did not do after testing, you realize that there's a cap on the resolution and you're actually just starting to resolve grain and dust and the peripheral aspects of the format. You're not actually getting any more resolution out of the capture system. Right. So it's interesting. You know, a lot of folks were, it's not in 4K. Well, truthfully, if you just up-res the 2K, it's going to be the same resolution at some point because you're not, the visual system doesn't provide any more detail. So now you're better off just making a bigger file.
So you mean I need to stop demanding 4K HDR Blu-rays for all of my favorite 16 millimeter films?
Correct.
It's been a waste of time. I have to get off these message boards. Damn it.
Yeah, certainly.
This guy.
At some point, it's diminishing returns.
Oh, so I got to go like Origin in 4K when? Question mark. I got to
exactly.
go.
Exactly. Okay, yeah.
Perfect.
Exactly.
Thank you.
So, Matt, if we shift gears a little bit, I mean, this feature film, you also, though, do music videos, and there's a very different dynamic there, right? Okay. And so I was looking at a couple. I mean, Praise You with Rita Ora, Doja Cat, you did the Vegas video. And I noticed, like, lots of camera movement, lots of beautiful warm tones and lighting. Can you talk a bit about how you captured those shots and, like, the movement that you're using there?
Yeah, again, you know, much like Ava, both Child, the director of the Doja Cat video, and Taika Waititi, the director of the Rita Ora video, are incredible visual artists. I mean, I think honestly, Child is to me a visual artist in the truest sense. Like all of our collaborations have just been me desperately trying to keep up with her and the overwhelming visual sensibility that she has is really stunning. So that Doja Cat was our first, I think we had done some commercials maybe, but that Doja Cat was my first time watching her force as an artist unfold in front of me. And I'm telling you, I run with the best of them, but that was a sprint for me, just physically, creatively. She's moving through stuff. She's coming up with, you know, really compelling visual vignettes to go after. Will call out anything. Like, I mean, immediately if something is not right, she's like, what is this? What is this lighting? What's happening? You know, like is just operating on truly on another level. She's going to be a spectacular force in movies when that starts to unfold. And, so Vegas was very much me watching, you know, somebody from a, you know, not a much younger generation, but a little bit younger, kind of unfold and realizing like that the visual acuity has shifted a lot. And so the awareness of kind of what's happening with the lighting and the costume design, the sets, the you know, that was right. All kind of one location that we reused for a bunch of different vignettes.
Is that like a challenge for you where, you know, you might have a certain style? Because that's interesting, the sort of generational thing, right? We kind of, I think a lot of creatives, we kind of get stuck in our ways or we have a certain style we've developed after many years.
Yeah.
So was that a challenge to kind of mold your style or change your style?
I don't have an overwhelming sense of self-importance. So to me, I'm really just like in awe of the forces of the people that I'm working with. And when I'm with someone who is extremely visual, like Child, like Ava, you know, who just sort of immediately know if they like something, if they don't, why they don't like it, like can communicate, even if it's not like exactly technical in its description, it's very clear, like that feels too strong, this feels too weak, like there's just a communication that you can, once you're in the flow, you can see what they're talking about and try, you know, truthfully, I mean, it's only going to get better, right? I mean, to me, it's like if you're defending something that you've done, to me, that has diminishing returns because it's never going to get any better if you don't try something else. So it's a very additive process. Like I'll come in, I'll put something together quick, put the camera up as quickly as possible. In the situation with Doja Cat, it was, you know, I would set it up, get it lit, And Child just comes over and starts to, okay, and she's redressing, changing colors in the thing. Okay, I don't love that the lighting feels too strong here. Can we do something else? And it's evolving very quickly. And then, you know, and then occasionally you get it right and she'll walk in and like, yes, let's go. You know, and those are great moments, you know, it's just selfishly, you're like, okay,
we got it.
I did something. So I loved watching that. And then, you know, Taika and I are old pals. So, you know, the thing with Rita, and obviously they have an ongoing relationship. And so to get to do something that felt very kind of like fun and family, and just like, you know, everybody kind of knew everybody, and we just sort of ran around. He's very fluid, and obviously like the comedy part plays plays into it. So it's visual, but it's sort of like has its basis. Like we were sort of looking at the Bob Fosse film, All That Jazz.
Oh man, that's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah,
thank you.
So we watched that, and he was like, look, if we just do this and then it turns into like a 2022 concert, that's gonna be really fun. She'll do the costume change, pop out the thing, and then it'll just be lights and glam and, you know, sparkling confetti or whatever's going on.
Make it happen, Matt.
So we'll, you know, we sort of go in with those ideas, and then he just runs it like, I mean, literally you're just rolling. He's talking through it and switching it up, talking to her. There's a very whole cool kind of narrative component to his work, you know, that played out in that music video, which really is sort of more of a short film in a way. It's like,
absolutely,
you know, the whole run up and lead up. So it's just that stuff is demanding in its own way, in terms of like the energy is very high and you're going, but you're laughing all day long. And he, you know, he's just, he's a force of nature in his own right. So you just fall into that rhythm and start to make him. So it's not as ceremonial or like, you know, fixed. It's a little bit looser and fun in that way.
Flowing. So there's lots of dynamic camera movement in that. And I know we are primarily a gear show. So can you tell us a little bit about the gear that you're using? And then I got a follow up to that.
I'm using like overall or
yeah. Well, I just seem like lots of moves, lots of presses, lots of transitions and direction.
Yeah. I mean, the music video stuff, you know, we're I almost always have a steady cam operator, you know, several that I've worked with for years who are very dear friends and tend to sort of come through and, help me out from time to time on those things, you know, So Dana Morris is a really good friend of mine and has worked with Taika for years. So he was there for the Praise You video and just sort of, you know, doing his thing. If you don't know his work, it's worth looking up, you know, I, Tonya, a couple of King Richard, you know, to name a few. But really...
Is that something you like visually yourself or your style?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not particular one way or the other going into something. Like if I know that it's more of a composed situation and tableaus and stuff, we won't even bring Steadicam, you know? So I tend to really lock into the core of what we're doing and then make those selections. I don't reverse engineer it to suit like what we had on the truck on the last show, which works for some folks, you know, to keep using the same tools and have the same language. I've never been particular about what's there. I just want what's there to be used and work. And I don't like to carry around a lot of things I'm not going to use.
So very flexible, very open to different techniques, technology.
Right. And I have a sense that, you know, the last few years there's been a lot of operating again. You know, it's interesting to have a career where you start, you know, literally never taking a camera out of your hand. And then you go into a bunch of big movies where you can't really do that because you got 9 million other things going on, and meetings and phone calls in between setups and all kinds of like, oh, we got to go scout this. And you just, it's not realistic to sit with the camera while all of that's happening. So, you know, you do a span of your career where you put the camera down and you meet other great operators and people that can do the work, and then come back to, you know, the last 5 or so years with somebody like Ava, where it's like, I need you to hold the camera all the time, you know? And so you end up in having these sort of periods where you've learned something new, you're coming back to it, you're remembering your old, you know, the muscle memory of doing all that sort of stuff. So as it relates to the gear, like, I tend to feel like having human beings holding the camera has a very different effect than having the robot holding the camera and having the human beings like 20 yards away at the thing. My friend and incredible cinematographer and visual artist, Arthur Jaffa, has always talked about like the effect of an a camera that has no human behind it, and what the sort of visual semantics of a personless camera are, you know, and how you sort of, you can immediately feel it somehow. Right. Just was, even if there's just me setting a frame and locking it off and standing next to the camera.
Right.
Is there,
feels different,
a sensibility change, right? Because you feel like it could change, you know, whereas like when you lock off a camera and walk away, or you're on a stabilized robotic head and you're, you know, on the other side of the ball field or whatever. And, you know, it does have a sensibility. I think that the way that performers are when there's people around versus not around, it's like all these things kind of add up to something in the end. So I've always sensed that I like the human component of it. Like,
yeah. That's cool. We don't get to see that in the background, right? We don't get to see the behind the scenes very often and see that dynamic. So
yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting. And you go on some sets now and you don't see anybody. And then you go on other sets and it's complete chaos and people running around all over the place. And like those two things, even if it's the exact same shots and the exact same scene,
it changes the feel.
The additive effect of it is just different. The energy is different. Mm. So, you know, I've always felt like my tendency is to stay close to the action. So, you know, I tend to like tools that are simple and quick.
So that brings me to my next question then. So, I mean, we're all getting older. We've been in this industry for a long time. You started on film, which is great. So with all the stuff that's changed now, I feel like 20 years ago, we really built on a lot of the stuff from the 40s and the 60s and, you know, all that kind of technology. But now we've got powerful laptop workstations. We've got mirrorless cameras. We've got, you know, compact gimbals, AI, of course. Like, so how has that changed? Because like, yeah, how has that changed you? Like as a technology, what do you think has been most impactful with all the stuff that we have nowadays?
I mean, certainly like the obvious one is the digitization of image capture has made up vastly, first of all, increase the output by such a huge amount that to even talk about the visual landscape now versus 20 years ago is, it's almost incomparable, like where you just have, you're inundated with so much material and so much of it is good. Like that's the other, you know, it's like, say what you will about the end result, but just photographically there's a lot out there. People are trying a lot of things. You're seeing a lot of new trends that are, you know, perhaps shorter lived, but people are risking more. They're trying more. They can see what they're doing. So you end up with things that are just by default, at least a little bit more experimental, if not, you know, more interesting. And so I will forever be, you know, having started just pushing on a skateboard around, you know, the various cities in Canada in the late 90s, filming with a VX1000. I understand the democratization and the sort of like the DIY energy of modern filmmaking is like very clear to me, and it's kind of in my DNA at this point. And so, you know, obviously the cameras, the smaller they get, the more interesting, you know, I mean, literally like on, you know, if I'm in a handheld digital environment, it's like, there's nothing on the camera. And the thing is literally like the box, the lens, and one rod for the focus. If I'm not just like, you know, riding, if it's not appropriate, if we want a better batting average than just me doing the focus by myself. I mean, it's like, get all of that stuff off the camera, make it as small as you can, because that's ultimately the goal, right? Is for me to be able to just, you know, like have right. it, you know, this size. So that's the biggest push for me. That's the thing I love the most, like get these things smaller, get them lighter, get them in places they haven't been before, but still an image that I can work with. You know, I'm, right. I spent a lot of time in finishing, a lot of time in DaVinci Resolve, a lot of time grade, you know, looking at different modalities for how to grade things, how to improve shots that have been already captured. You know, right. I grew up in the Photoshop era. You know, I can remember like Photoshop 1. It's like,
right.
and Adobe Creative Suite and all these sort of things that were like at the time huge deals. You know, you go like, It in your early 20s to buy like the new Adobe suite, and it's like thousands of dollars that you've worked for months to save
up. Windows 98
store, yeah. Right? I mean, that
well,
was like
actually you mentioned something that I'm curious if you've played with. You've mentioned making the camera smaller and getting it in easier to places, but still having usable footage. Have you used ProRes on iPhone?
I have. We did a whole set of commercials for a very popular American corporation, and we use the ProRes function on the iPhone. I really love it. What I don't like can't get around with the iPhone is the lensing. I just for the life of me can't work out why we don't do just make a non-phone version of the thing that's just the screen, right. And give us something where we can, you know, put a single lens up, because it's the space in between 0.5 and 1. I need that space, but it's a digital crop. At some point it hands off, even in the zooming of it. You know, I still shoot a lot of skateboarding stuff, you know, because that's kind of a lot of my friends and people I hang out with, and I'm doing it with my son. And that's all, you know, most of that capture now, the way that skateboarding media changed is, you know, just individual clips posted to people's social media. So I'm always like trying to figure out how to make the phone work. And just really wanting it to be like the old servo zooms and be able to use the full range. But when you jump between the lenses, it's having to compute the space in between the focal lengths. So it,
right.
Still needs some work, I'll say. But as a general idea, I like it. And then, you know, with the other stuff like the gimbals and the, you know, to me, it's like if it works, I love it. Like if somebody brings me something and they know how it functions, because like my brain is now full of all the things I'm going to learn how to use. So I just need someone who can really express the potential of the technology to bring it to me, and then I'm down. You know, like a friend of mine who's done almost every movie I've ever done is like kind of a Ronin enthusiast, and we'll carry that thing and I'll just like wherever we can throw it in, it's great. You know, if we don't have to use track, it's great. I can, you know, I've kind of learned the stabilization back end, like in Resolve you can stabilize a lot of stuff, so if you get any of that wonky wiggle, you can take it out pretty easily, frame a little wider. Yeah. And you know, it's like those things, and when people see that, they're like, holy smokes, like you guys just did that in the tent and now it's in dailies stabilized. And you know, it the stuff's not that tricky, and I think that the movie business in general tries to preserve itself a little bit by like making the stuff harder than it needs to be. You know, it's just self-preservation, right? Like the more complicated, the more you need help.
I think a lot of people can learn from what you're saying here, in the sense of like we had a conversation before about like elitism or like just dismissing something because it's not
everywhere.
Don't do that, and you can do so much more if you just think about it. Like, what can I do?
Mm-hmm. That's a good segue, Matt, because it seems like you've really dodged the cynicism that some people fall into, right? Or maybe the creative people don't, because they're in the industry, but people who watch it, it's easy to be cynical about it, right? Because I was thinking about it, and you shot Spider-Man Far From Home, and the whole premise of that movie is about how modern technology and illusion basically can fool people and convince them and entertain them, and that becomes the new authentic, right? The fake becomes new authentic.
The fake news mentality, that was...
Right?
That was at peak conversation about... altered realities of delivery of information.
Right. We're all worrying now about AI and how's that going to change video and how's that going to change photography. But at the same time, you've worked on these sets where the cameras are on cranes and robotically operated, and there's a lot of meetings, a lot of planning, and it must be a very different dynamic. So can you tell us a bit about what it's like to be shooting that kind of thing where it's green screen and it's CGI and everything's planned out with VFX? How does that change? And does that make somebody cynical, or is there a lot of potential for creativity there?
I mean, I think that there's a reality to those films, and specifically, you know, my experience with Marvel Studios, which I think, you know, Kevin and that whole, you know, the legacy of that work is really astounding to me, that you have, I don't know how many films now, but well over 25, I mean, there might be at 30 films, maybe. I might have that number way low, but it's definitely getting up there.
It's probably double, yeah.
And you can line them up and play them, and there's a singularity in the vision across 10 plus 15 years of filmmaking. Like, you go one to the next, and it's like the language of those things, the brand recognition, the sort of totality of the vision is monumental to me. You know, I can remember being around, Taika and I were finishing Thor Ragnarok when they were doing the Infinity War Endgame co-shoot. Like, those movies were actually shot together, which, like, when you think about that, is mind-boggling. It's the undertaking. Yeah. You know, I to watch all of those things come together in such a true way just makes you, like, really step back in awe of what can be done when there's, you know, people, you know, sort of say, oh, it's filmmaking by committee, but it's really not. You know, it's one singular idea about a certain style of storytelling that is communicated across so many films. And just to be in there and be a part of that is like, I'm honestly, like, I have such deep reverence for the whole mechanism that they brought forth to work in that way. So, you know, I always fall into it. I people are cynical. Oh, I don't get control, or I don't. I'm like just really excited every time I get to go on to one of those things, because you're partaking in something that is exercising parts of the brain that you don't get to exercise that often. You know, like when you're literally sitting there being like, okay, so the thing takes place in Venice, Italy, but we're going to shoot the set piece in London. But when we get to Italy, it's going to be May, and the sun's going to be here on the bridge, and all those plates are going to look like that. So we have to like this, you know, you're really like doing 3D models of the orbit of the Earth so that you can figure out exactly where, you know, sun position is going to be, angles. I mean, it's like truly, you know, feels like working for NASA or something sometimes. And, and I love that. You know, I really, the genuine admiration I have for that type of filmmaking is you know, palpable.
Very cool.
Well, Matt, we could probably talk to you for another hour with ease.
Yes. But, I only have one more question.
Oh, so you're gonna,
if anybody else has questions.
No, this is it. Last question.
Is this the last question? We're sure? Okay. Yeah. Matt, why does the 35 millimeter focal length suck so bad?
Okay. All right.
All right. Well,
Matt, what's your opinion on that?
I think that, certainly there's beautiful work that has been done on a 35 millimeter lens. So I don't want to offend those shots out there that were.
I've already offended everybody. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. With that focal length. But I will say that I think that there is a point at which the difference between things becomes really relevant to filmmaking. Like, I can remember in some early textbook about how to photograph a scene, there was some indication that the angle of the shot needs to change by 45 degrees minimum, or the focal length needs to double for the shots to be cuttable. Now, obviously, that's nonsense, but you know, there is a reality to when images are put together in sequence. How is the language of the shot changing, indicating something to the viewer? And I think what ultimately, I have this theory that I try to only use in a numerical sequence, one focal length for each number, in sequence. So like one from the 10s, one from the 20s, one from the 30s, one from the 40s, 50s. So, you know, and obviously focal lengths are on an exponential curve, meaning that the difference between them on the wide end is much greater than the difference in the long end. So you often end up with more lower numbers than higher numbers. Like you might go 50, 7,500, but you might have 14, 18, 21, 25, you know. And so as you down to the wider end, you're often inundated with options. And so I try to thin out the options and to make the choice in the lensing specific enough that when you change a lens, it's meaningful, you know, because if you do a thing on a 21 and then go to a 25 and then a 27, those things are basically going to look the same, you know, reasonably. If you adjust the camera, you could probably fool a lot of people. And I think the 35 is a classic example of like, it's in between, you know, it's like that iPhone thing. It's like in between two, it's a focal length that falls in between the two dominant, because you get into 40 and you're like, okay, I can shoot a close up on a 40 millimeter lens and I can do a wide shot on a 32. But what am I doing with, it's like a mid situation, you know, where it's, I don't really have a purpose for this, but you could, you know, if you changed your sequencing and you went 27, 35 and skip the 32 and then go, you know, 35, 50, it's a different language, right? You don't get as, you don't get some of the bend and the bubbling, but you, you know, remove two focal lengths from that sequence and all of a sudden you understand the language of 27 or 25, 32, sorry, 27, 35, 50. You understand that language, you know, but mine would typically be more, you know, 25, 32, 40 would be like a run of lenses I've used pretty regularly.
That's a perfect answer, like, man.
That's incredibly well thought out to a weird answer to a weird soapbox Chris has been on for years. So, thank you.
He's going to keep pointing back to this as like
proof of why. It's less about the lens you're using and more about the lenses you're not using and what's going to come up before and after it when it's cut together is my feeling.
Beautiful. All right. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Matt. We appreciate it. Thanks for stopping by, talking movies with us. Yeah, maybe we'll have you again sometime the next time you have another movie to chat about.
Really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Huge honor. Thank you for joining us, Matt.
Thank you,
Matt. See you guys later.
All right. Well, thank you so much to Matt Lloyd for spending his very valuable time to talk to us. That was awesome. Really appreciated that. What have you guys been up to this last week? Jordan.
Oh, man, let me tell you, I went out to Panorama out in the mountains here in BC. We had a ski day, but also we booked this just insane house, basically, out there. It wasn't an Airbnb. It was like a private booking, but it had like two arcades in it, a mini golf course, 9 holes, just bananas, a hot tub. The pool was closed because it's still chilly. But man, I lived the life of luxury for a few days here, and I am absolutely cratering coming back home right now. Like, what? Why isn't everything fancy and and an absolute pleasure? So yeah, that was really cool. Went snowboarding again, had a fantastic time, even though it's kind of end of season. And I have decided before I was like, I think I'm going to buy a board. I think I'm it's decided. Next year I'm going to go out a lot more. I'm buying a board. I'm getting into it because I had a great time with my kid.
I'm glad that your family got happy Jordan, and it sounds like I'm going to get grumpy, vindictive Jordan. So that's awesome.
I wouldn't go so far as vindictive, but.
So anyone who's listening, last week, you may have heard that I am not at home right now. I am currently at my parents' house in the Salinas Valley. And so my whole podcasting setup was not normal, but somewhat coincidentally, or a happy accident, Logitech announced that they were going to do another camera last week, and it's a Micro Four Thirds streaming camera designed to be super easy. Well, I have it. Here it is. This is the Mevo Core. This is one of two they sent me. I'm actually using the Mevo Core right now, as mentioned earlier. So this is what it looks like. And here's the other thing. If you're like, it looks whatever, maybe the lighting's not ideal. I've got two lights here too. Logitech sent two strip lights. That I'm using to make sure that I am properly exposed. I don't really like the way that they're set up right now. I will hopefully change this next week. But here's some things I wanted to mention about the Mevo Core for anyone who's curious. As a webcam, you basically install the software, and all that software does is say,
I recognize that there's a Mevo Core camera over there. Thumbs up. Nothing else. I can adjust nothing about this camera.
Right.
I can't adjust the white balance. I can't tell it where to focus. I learn nothing about the camera through the software. It tells me no information. I have no data. Right. And then also earlier, I had a meeting where I was in a call and my stream was in 4K. And then we fired up our podcast, I don't know, 30 minutes later. Now I'm in 1080. I changed nothing. Didn't turn the camera off. Didn't even close
knows.
The... It just is like, oh, he doesn't want this in 4K. We'll go ahead.
They're psychic.
I didn't want it in 4K, but I'd like to know why.
They're psychic.
So there's a lot about this camera that I would like to know more information about. And to answer your question from last week, Jordan, you're like, I wonder if it has phase detection. I don't believe it does. I believe this is contrast-based, and it is having a very difficult time tracking my face and making sure that it is constantly in focus. I find that it's drifting.
I'm not noticing any pulsing, though. I mean, all things aside, the whole point of the Mevo Core cameras is that you don't have to
correct.
Do anything.
And it's
right?
fantastic like, at that.
That is what they want. That's their goal, is to be like, just plug it in and start using it, and we take all the guesswork away by being psychic and reading your mind. So there you go.
Yeah, if you want control, the BGH1 cameras are out there.
Is it bigger than this?
Yeah. Or is it It's almost size? Exactly the same size. Yeah,
yeah. Interesting. Maybe a little longer, but yeah.
Way more buttons.
The I will
covered
say
in quarter 20s.
It does have a full-size HDMI.
Nice.
Looking at you, Canon, for repeatedly not giving me one of these. and then micro SD, and then it's got two USBs.
Oh.
And then it has the quarter 20 screws on every side.
Nice.
Which is kind of neat.
That is nice.
I can appreciate that. But I really would like to know what it's doing. I would really if I knew that.
My week has been simple. I've been sick. It's great. But look at this. Well, this is my thing on my desk today. I'm a fisherman and these are my friends. So I'm going to show those friends to you. There you go. And we get to shoot today, Jordan. It'll be great. Oh, man.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
What a transition. Okay, let's do some tech support. All of these are, again, speak pipes. So let's burn through them. First one up is Chris Law. Let's listen in.
Hey, Petapixel guys. This is Chris from Nashville, Tennessee. I've got a question for Jordan about how to mic up people using lavs. I've got the Rode Wireless Pros, and when using the lavs, especially if I'm trying to hide them, I seem to get a lot of clothing rustling noises, and I'm wondering if there's any accessories you use or any other tips you've got just to position those lav mics really well and avoid getting rustling.
Yeah, we use Rycote undercovers, which are wonderful little basic. There's a few different styles of them. There's also overcovers, but basically it's sticky fur that you can put on either side of it, like just one side if you want, or we can actually use double side and then you can put it between a jacket. And I got onto those just because I knew a bunch of guys in the film business were using them all the time, and they work very well. Now, there are still some issues. I have a fuzzy chest that leads to a lot of trouble if we use like a single furry on one side just to cover the clothing noise. I do get some on my chest as well. We've joked for a long time that I need to just shave a perfect circle into the middle of my chest.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's where we'll
please.
Stick it. Yeah. My wife has mixed feelings about that, but
I'm going to wax your chest with or without your permission. And it's a real problem.
Yeah, one other technique I really love is if your host is wearing a baseball cap. My favorite trick is actually run the line over top of the head from behind and actually attach it in the brim. Works great because then as they rotate their head, the distance from the microphone doesn't shift at all. That's one of my favorite little techniques as well.
I've never used that technique.
Works really well. So that's another one. But can't speak highly enough about the Rycotes. It is something that's tricky. You know, a lot of the time I'll just be like, Chris, I'm sorry, your camera strap is over your chest and it's bumping into your microphone and stuff. The best suggestion I can give you is just always have headphones in, always be monitoring. ABM, always be monitoring.
And even with the Rycotes, like it can't be rubbing against clothing. Like you can't put it inside a shirt against another shirt in a lot of cases. We often actually have it on a jacket lapel or where the zipper is to try to hide it to some degree, but still have it out so it's not rubbing anything. But you always have issues with buttons clacking against themselves, or, you know, a camera strap rubbing, or just the nature of the material of the jacket making noise. It is challenging. I'm sure in the industry, there's lots of fancy like rubber things. We experimented with those, but yeah, it's challenging. We often now just default to visible vampire clips because they do take a lot of the issues away, even though you can see this weird fuzzy black thing on your chest.
Yeah, that was the big thing I wanted to say, is I was obsessive about we can't see the microphone in the early days, coming from like filmmaking background. But at a certain point, I'm like, who are we trying to, like, they know he's a YouTube presenter talking about stuff. Just put the fuzzy thing on him and don't worry about the clothing noise as much. Where if we're doing something that is more like a short film style, like the thing we did with Levi Hallwell for the intro to the RF lens video. Yeah, we're hiding the mics there. We want it to look like a movie.
Bring a boom mic operator with you everywhere. Easy. All right, next one.
All right, next question is from Nicholas. Let's listen in.
Hi, Chris and Jordan. I recently bought a used Nikon Z6 II for an incredible deal, $550. But the shutter count is 130,000. That means it's probably about to die. Should I sell my Fujifilm X-A7 and X-T1 to get a Nikon autofocus lens and run it until it dies? Or should I sell the Nikon and get more lenses for my Fujifilm? I'm having fun with the Nikon and some adapted manual lenses using the electronic shutter, but I keep wondering if it will die at the worst time, such as a hike, family event, or upcoming eclipse.
I don't know, Nicholas. I mean, yeah, of course, it's always a concern that your shutter could fail at any moment, but I mean, your camera could fail at any moment, right? I mean, digital equipment, it's very reliable for the most part, but 130,000 is high, but the camera probably still has many shots to go. And to be fair, most people don't shoot that many photos a year. Your mileage might vary, but even in our job, I think I was working it out. I mean, I maybe shoot 10,000 shots a year, you know, probably less than that, you know, and we're doing it professionally twice a week. So you probably still have quite a bit of life in that shutter. I think it'll last you quite a few years. I guess if it was me personally, I wouldn't, I would keep using it. I would, you know, so yeah, sell your Fujifilm stuff if you want to have the budget to then get other lenses. I think it'll last you still quite, especially when you only pay $550 for it. Run it till it dies. I don't think it's going to die on you anytime soon.
Yeah, that was my experience at the camera store, is, you know, the shutter life is an expectation, and especially it's like, we will still service it if it's within warranty, which this camera isn't. So it's not a big concern. But I honestly find that the majority of the time you go way over what the manufacturers say the shutter is capable of. And don't forget, like, it's not the fastest scanning sensor, but your shutter goes, you can shoot that camera in electronic shutter mode as well.
You know, unless it goes and breaks closed.
But I mean, 150,000 actuations is what they rate it for.
Open like this, you go,
tear it out with pliers.
That's what you do.
But you know, 150,000, you got 20,000 shots on there still. It'll probably go much longer than that. And you know, you might not be shooting that many shots every year. So I think you're going to be okay.
Cool. All right. Next one is from Sean. It's another speak pipe. Let's go.
How's it going, Chris, Jaren, and Jordan? Sean here from Nova Scotia. Love the podcast, love the YouTube channel, and just in general. Keep it up. Record this plenty of times. I'm going to see if I can make it less complicated than it's been in all the other iterations. So, the Fujifilm 40 megapixel sensor, how does that differ from, let's say, a 40 megapixel full frame sensor in terms of image quality, let's say? Because I'm looking, like, I understand the megapixels are smaller on the crop sensor camera compared to a full frame, which then gives you the benefits of like bokeh as well as low light performance. But I'm looking more in terms of like, is there an actual image quality in like perfect light scenarios? And with that being said, would it be, I know there's always equivalencies, comparisons compared to full frame crop sensor, like this 35 mil lens is equivalent to a, let's say 50 mil lens on a full frame. Does it work that way in terms of megapixels on a sensor? Would that 40 megapixel crop sensor be equivalent to like a 68 or so megapixel full frame in terms of like pixel density within that sensor? I don't know if that made any sense. I don't know if this was a confusing question or a good question in general, but again, love the show, guys. Take care.
That is a good question, Sean. I mean, you know, Sean's already saying he understands the differences as far as equivalency goes. The APS-C size sensors will give you more depth of field, about a stop equivalent, compared to a full frame. The full frame will be shallower by a stop for the same given aperture on a lens. You know, dynamic range is going to be a little bit better on a full frame. Low light performance will be a little better on a full frame for a given ISO. But again, that's if you're talking perfect lighting, like a studio situation.
Perfect lighting, both of them in ideal situations, side by side. Same lens, same exact focal length.
Probably not
going to
notice much difference. No. Yeah, assuming that you use the equivalent focal length and all that, and you know, and you even match up depth of field, you'd be hard pressed to notice much difference. And primarily, when it comes to megapixels, assuming that the camera's sharp, the lenses are well focused, and they're appropriate for that resolution, you're not going to see much resolution difference between the two sensor sizes, I don't think.
Exactly. Yeah, there'll be if you manage to meter everything out so it is equivalent, you will get the same level of sharpness.
Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. Yeah. This last one is a speak pipe, but I'm not going to play it because it was incomplete. So Peter McLeod, you sent us a speak pipe and I think it just stopped recording because it didn't finish. But he was saying that he had a question that wasn't about equipment. That's all we know. He was more of a travel question. He says that he's coming and doing a bunch of stuff around the West. He's going to start in LA, go to the Grand Canyon, then he's going to Monument Valley, Bryce Canyon, Zion, Las Vegas for a couple of days to lose some money, Death Valley, Yosemite. He wanted to go through Mono Lake, but because of the time of year he's going, those roads will be closed. So he's instead going around the long way through Bakersfield and Fresno, which looks pretty boring, he says.
It is.
He's right. Yes, it is. It's horrible. San Francisco, Monterey, and Carmel. He's going to go to Sushi Heaven, which we went to. Big thumbs up there. And then it's Santa Barbara, LAX, and then home again. So this is where he gets to the part where he says, so what am I looking for? Well, I've never been to the West United States, so I'm looking for some, and it cuts off. So I think he's asking, what in these areas should he be sure not to miss?
Yeah.
Jeremy, you're the king of Western United States, so this almost, I think I would defer to you here.
It is sad that he's not going to be able to go through Mono Lake, because Mono Lake is incredible regardless of season. And then there's also Bishop is out there, and the mountains in that area are insane. If you could swing it, I would try and go to Mono Lake and then turn around and go the long way again. Even if you intend to spend the whole next day on the road and skip Bakersfield and Fresno, which you should anyway.
sorry, Fresnonians or Fresnites.
They know it's not pretty.
I drove through there once. It's not that pretty.
I used to make that drive pretty regularly. I'd drive down from San Francisco to LA because I had work down there. And that whole drive, that section of it was horrible.
But it's a great place to get gas on your way to Yosemite. So for that, fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic gas stop for Yosemite.
If you're going to come up to Monterey and Carmel, someplace that I didn't take these two, which I would take them again, is Big Sur. I would go to Big Sur and see some of that. You don't even really have to leave the freeway. You can just drive it and pull off whenever you see a good view you want to take a picture of.
I have done that drive. My wife and I did actually a very similar road trip. We didn't go to Utah, but we did the whole West Coast all the way down. Then we went through Bakersfield and Fresno into Yosemite, past Mono Lake, and it's all fantastic. So, yeah, Big Sur is beautiful. The bridges are great to shoot. The Bixby Bridge, of course, maybe overshot, but that's always a nice photo stop.
I mean, you could actually take that route if you're trying to go down to Santa Barbara. That whole road, just drive it. Just drive that whole road.
Yeah, it's gorgeous, 100%.
Totally worth
it. Yosemite's great. I didn't spend much time there. We spent a couple days there, but it was nice. But going over the back end down into Nevada, that was actually, I didn't think it'd be exciting, but it's like you're on the moon. It's beautiful and eerie and just gorgeous and something you don't often see. And if you're doing Vegas, I mean, my wife and I stopped in Reno, and that was kind of a fun trip because it's like,
Reno's not bad. I like Reno.
It's like poor man's Vegas, and it's great.
I was going to say it's dirty Vegas.
Dirty Vegas. You won't lose as much money, and the hotels are like half the price, and it's actually kind of cute. Yeah. The city itself is kind of cute. One thing that I regret that we didn't have time for was then going from there into Lake Tahoe. I think that would be a really cool thing to visit. We didn't really get to do that loop, but yeah, driving through Utah, that'd be cool.
I'd love to do that.
This route you've picked is fantastic. If you just, if you take Highway 1, once you get to California, go through Big Sur and take Highway 1 all the way down to Santa Barbara, I think you will not be disappointed. There's Avila Beach is beautiful. Yeah. San Luis Obispo is really pretty. There's a bunch of little surf towns all through that way that are you're just going to want to stop. And I highly
Santa Cruz is cute. Yeah, there's so many great places to stop. Yeah. One of the best road trips ever of all time. It was great.
Ever of all time. Okay.
Ever of all time.
Hopefully, Peter, that was what you were looking for. If not, sorry.
Leave another speak pipe.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, moving
Probably like, so I'm looking for some camera stores along the way. Do you guys have any suggestions? We're like, oh, we totally missed what he wanted. Oh,
nope. All right, so we're going to move on to Never Read the Comments, the section where we make sure to always read every comment, which we do religiously. Let's talk a little bit about your trio of lenses from the Chinese manufacturers, and there were multiple requests to see Viltrox lens reviews from the two of you.
Viltrox, big time.
That's okay, because I have arranged for two to come to you. What they are will remain a mystery until we are allowed to talk about them. But they are on their way, and I approved both of the focal lengths, and I think they are both going to be very interesting.
Yeah.
They may be included on their own. They may be part of another group of lenses that you're going to just do a showcase on. We'll see. But yes, for those listening, you will get Viltrox.
Yeah, I think the Chinese lens video was quite eye-opening because it's something, you know, not that we were trying to ignore them. We just never had the contacts before. And, you know, we did play with Laowa. I mean, we've always been loyal to Laowa and reviewed their products. But it was eye-opening to see some of the other brands and really start to play with them. And I think they're kind of transitioning now into lenses that aren't just like cheap toys, but actually can be interesting optical lenses. So I'm eager to play with more.
Yeah,
that's what I'm trying to get at.
I would like to do like a quarterly rundown of some of the latest. We can't do dedicated videos. There's so many manufacturers and they're just pumping lenses out. But just like we did before, kind of, okay, what is the current state of Chinese lenses? Are there any like surprising gems that you may not have heard of? I think that's the format that we'll take moving forward. So you can look forward to more of those. I mean, I've already, since we posted that video, received another very interesting one here that might be in the rack.
And one of our most ardent and loyal listeners, JL Williams, he actually really liked that sort of three lenses in one video, quick looks, and he's normally quite critical of our work, especially mine. So for JL, we're going to do more of those for you.
Any approval from JL, we will do what just he wants JL just to like keep me. Him from making Chris
When I told you that we read every comment, that's obvious. There's one more I wanted to call out from here, from XA Saint. Does Jordan have any opinion on the Laowa 10 for video? I'm thinking of capturing certain types of B-roll with it could be useful. Thoughts, Jordan?
Yeah, I mean, it's a 10 millimeter is so extreme for video. Like when I'm shooting video, I always want my lens to draw as little attention as possible. Like 20 mils on a full frame is generally as wide as I like to use it, unless it's for an effect shot. But for like skateboarding, things like that, I could see it being quite useful, especially now that we've got autofocus. That is one thing where like I have a Laowa 12 millimeter that I shot some video with, but I had a really tough time finding use cases for it. Now that we've got autofocus for action, I think that would work quite well. But yeah, it's extremely niche. It's going to draw so much attention to itself. I could find it being quite useful if you're jumping between Super 35 and full frame quite a bit. 15 mils, I would say, is quite a bit more usable as a very wide angle, you know, for gimbal shots and stuff like that. But you're still going to get not barrel distortion, but actual perspective distortion at the edges of the frame. They're going to move faster than what's in the middle of the frame. There's no way around it. And that might be the look that you want to make poor things. And in that case, go right ahead. But not something I would use all the time, but could be fun for effects or time lapse. I think this would be great. You know,
I was also thinking that one shot you did of Chris when he decided he was going to take a bike jump with his legs, and he like,
oh yeah,
it would have been great for that. You would have been really good for that shot.
Wouldn't lose him in the frame when he just absolutely ate it on the other side.
But I'd look so small and far off in the distance.
It would make your jump look incredibly high. So that, I mean, it would pay off.
Oh, if I got low with that, he could do a bunny hop and it would look like he's sailing through the sky. Yeah,
exactly. From the last podcast, George EQ1115 said, I enjoyed the high energy, Jordan. Don't let them dim your light. From the intro, but
I was writing it in a little bit this week.
Bish Watnell says, thanks, Jordan, for your softer entry. So, you know, can't please everyone.
Undecided.
JL, can you tell us what you think about Jordan's where you want it to be? Because that's what we'll do.
You're now the producer of our show, effectively, yeah. JL.
Yeah. We will, you're the creative director.
I'm just going to flip a coin every episode. Heads is loud, Jordan. Tails is quiet, Jordan. And we'll see what we get.
So the last group here are the early comments from the 50mm 1.2 Art Lens review. Lens. You guys really liked it. Mr. Cranberry says, Chris, I know you tried... It's cram, not cran. Like cram.
Cram them berries.
It's even better. Chris,
I know you like... You tried the 50 Leica SL primes. You really think that the Sigma is the best 50mm L-mount lens to date?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so the 50 Leica SL primes, like the Apo 1.4 is a fast lens. It is optically beautiful for sure. But yeah, I still think the 50 mil, because you have to look at it in terms of a whole bunch of stuff, like price versus what you're getting, the fact that the Sigma 50mm f1.2 is very good at 1.2, right? I even said in my article, I've always been kind of the guy who's like, 1.2 is pointless. It's extravagant. It's superfluous. Rarely are you going to use it. It's usually not good there anyways. So what's the point? But this Sigma really quite impressed me because at 1.2, it's absolutely fantastic, very usable, not incredibly heavy, not expensive. Like that's another one of the important factors here. When you're at a price that's very competitive to other 1.4 lenses and you can get a usable 1.2 and it really didn't have a lot of other optical compromises, I think, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. As one, now not everybody should buy it, you know, not everybody needs it, but given what Sigma did for that price budget and what it does optically, yeah, I think it's great.
Yeah, it's way, I mean, just compare the price to the Leica, and I would say the Sigma is a way more usable lens. For L mount, I think it's the best choice currently available. And for E mount as well, like I love the Sony 50mm 1.2, but I loved the Sigma pretty much just as much for two thirds of the price.
Yeah. They banger, did a banger. Great job there. And the bokeh is beautiful. Like the like that would be one of those things where you can always talk about sharpness and contrast, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, but bokeh is one of those things where people are like, oh, that's where really you can see engineering come into play. And the bokeh is gorgeous. It's beautiful on it. It's smooth. It's got beautiful specular highlights, a really nice cat's eye effect, wide open. Like
some people that don't is like something the cat's
that's
eye.
Very... I do like the cat's eye. I don't mind the cat's eye vignetting. I think it can be a lot of fun in certain situations with that kind of swirly look. Not pet small, but swirly, certainly. Yeah.
Banger bangers, how I'm going to choose to pronounce this. It's BNGR_BNGR.
Banger banger.
Were they
banger,
referring banger. To the 50mm f1.2 from Sigma? Because that lens is a banger banger.
Yes, and it is weather sealed.
If it's weather sealed. So, and you're saying
it's an art series lens. It's well built. It's got seals. It's got rubber mounting seals. It's well sealed. Yeah.
All right. So the second to last one is from Inward Lens. They ask, or they say, it would be great if you guys could start testing lenses for internal reflections. It was never really a concern for me until I started noticing it on product shots on white, especially a dark object. The Sigma Art 24-70 has it particularly bad, and I no longer use it for product work because of this. I'm sure other people would be interested to know this since that photo category is in such high demand now. I did not know that it was in such high demand now, but okay. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean it's there's so many variables there. Like we have seen... Like we've seen cameras that actually have worse internal reflections on them. You know, it's a matter of the light bouncing off the sensor, it would back into the internal elements with that. So it's a tough thing to consistently state like this has real issues. I mean, certainly if we see it a lot in images, we could point it out. But it's probably not something that we're going to test for specifically.
Not that it's not valid. You know, I mean, there was an interesting one last week where the person was saying, oh, they're getting internal reflections off the actual writing on the lens ring off of a filter, right? Like, but it also illustrates the fact that these are absolutely important things to find out, but there are also so many variables that testing it becomes, I mean, there are people out there that do hour-long lens reviews and there you go. And we don't because nobody wants to listen to me talk for more than 20 minutes.
Okay.
You guys are probably sick of me now.
I mean, I haven't heard Jordan enough this episode. I'll say that much. Last one.
Yeah, Jordan, what's your problem?
A lot of questions weren't directed to me.
Aref Al-Raghi RFL, they say, LOL, people complain about Chris shooting fast lenses at f4. In the very next video, Chris's first images of the 51-2 is shot at f8. Way to stand up for your ways, Chris. Yeah.
Totally. I specifically shot that Sigma at 1.2 a lot. So, you know, a lot of the sample photos in there are shot wide open at 1.2, but a lens is a lens. The beautiful thing about a 51.2 is you can also shoot it at 1.4 and 2 and 2.8 and 4 and 5.6 and my favorite 7.1 and f8 and 11 and 16 and so on and so forth. So, yeah, that's a lens. It's got so many apertures I get to play with. And 35 millimeter still sucks. Thank you, Matt, for confirming that in a very professional, eloquent, and
he gave a good reason for it that you have not given, really. So
because the truth is truth. It doesn't matter if you back it up. Truth is truth. And yeah, I appreciate Matt confirming that for me.
All right, well.
I mean, we don't know what format he was referring to. He could have been talking about Super 35, where it's actually a 50 millimeter full frame equivalent, and he's disagreeing with you the entire time, and you didn't realize it. That's also a possibility.
Well, I'm going to choose to believe that.
Follow-up. Yeah. Format do you dislike 35, Matt?
He understands that full frame is the universal format when talking about
Maybe he was talking about Super 16, and it's like a 75. Stop it. shot a movie in that format.
Nobody hates 75. Nobody hates 75. 75 is gorgeous.
Well, with that, we're going to end on that argument yet again. Thanks for joining us this week. We'll see you next week. Have a good one, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.